My fellow Americans and all those listening overseas, welcome back to Visiting the President. I'm your host, Joe Fakush, and today we are on the road to North Bend, Ohio, just outside of Cincinnati, and the gravesite of William Henry Harrison, 9th President of the United States. Before I go too far, I want to remind you to be checking out visitingthepresidents.com, where you can find previous episodes, links to associated readings for the presidential sites, my photos from various trips, recommended readings, and so much more. You can also follow along on the social media profiles at Visiting the President on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, where I provide additional content throughout the week. Liking and commenting helps to raise the profile, and I appreciate any of you who've written a review for Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. You'll also find a link to help support Visiting the President through PayPal. Your support helps to fund the production, editing, and hosting of Visiting the President's episodes and the website, as well as future trips and books. All support is greatly appreciated, but at the top of the Mount Rushmore giving is Sammy and Tom Fakush, Nancy and Terry Workamp, Debbie and Dennis Fakush, Harvey and Casey Hyman, Connie and Adam Luck, Brittany and Keith Mellon, Stephanie Gaskill, Gail Rittenhouse, and Andrew Alexander. Also, Jim and Catherine Hyman, Sean and Liz Jones, Stephen Gilroy, Kurt Dion, Alexis Mira, April McKenzie, Matt and Megan Hochstetler, Caitlin Cahalan, Jim and Laurel Brayler, Eric Engartner, Patricia Argentina, Kara Steiner, Jamie and Ted Wilson, Candy and Ben Phelps, Lana Demers and Craig Hunter, Kenneth Robinson, Thomas Kalina, Kristen and Steve Wendell, and Alex Seiker. Thank you all so much. I recommend you also go back and listen to the previous season's episodes on each president, as that's where we'll pick up the action. For William Henry Harrison, you could check out season one's William Henry Harrison in Berkeley Plantation for his birthplace and his education and upbringing, and then season two's William Henry Harrison in Grouseland for all of his homes. Where we left off the action, William Henry Harrison had just been elected president in 1840 and would be the oldest president to take office. He would be the oldest man ever inaugurated at 68 years old. He has since been surpassed by Ronald Reagan, Donald Trump, and Joe Biden. William Henry Harrison's campaign had been built around allaying those fears of Harrison's age. And the rhetoric around Harrison was the same as the Old Hickory campaigns of Andrew Jackson, that their battle-hardened bona fides would override any concerns over either man's fitness. John Quincy Adams, for one, was dubious, as the way the campaign had been waged, as we talked about in season two, where it was going to get into the really kind of messy particulars and actual lying, obscuring of William Henry Harrison's upbringing. But then also he was dubious of Harrison's ability to be his own man and whether or not he would be able to stand up to the forces of men like Henry Clay or Daniel Webster. Harrison comes in upon a hurricane. God grant he may not go out upon a wreck, is what John Quincy Adams said, and he will obviously be correct. Anna Harrison said of the president-elect, "I wish that my husband's friends had left him where he is, happy and contented in retirement." And it kind of reminds me of the rhetoric around when King Charles took the throne. And I thought, like, how many people have to wait until their 70s before they ascend to the big job, right? And so, you know, certainly that is going to be something that a lot of people were concerned with. It wasn't lost to them. Harrison expended then a lot of energy trying to demonstrate his youth and vigor and his ability to be his own man. He was very sensitive to the criticism that he would defer to powerful Henry Clay, who was still angry at being passed over as a nominee in 1840. But he played right into the former speaker's trap when Henry Clay convinces him to spend a week at Clay's estate in Lexington, and then while he's there, declines Harrison's offer to be Secretary of State just to kind of run the show from the Senate and possibly set him up for the 1844 election. I should also note that Harrison was grieving the loss of several children in the years leading up to the presidency. It's something we've talked about with some of our previous presidents where it does play a role, even if it's underreported or something that we don't always emphasize. We'll discuss it a bit later when we talk about what kind of grief poor Anna Harrison is dealing with. William Henry will arrive in Washington on February the 9th, 1841, and he'll have taken off from Cincinnati, all these well-wishers, and every stop that he made along the way to Washington, everybody's going to come out. They have these big Tippecanoe parties. He's greeted by the mayor, and it would be a bit exhausting. And when he gets to Washington, he's immediately besieged by well-wishers and office seekers when he sets up shop at the National Hotel. Harrison swung by the executive mansion in a completely guileless moment to call on President Martin Van Buren, and Van Buren will be completely charmed by the man who defeated him. The next day, President Van Buren will return the favor, bringing his entire cabinet to the National, and then even throwing a party and dinner for the president-elect at the Executive Mansion. There was such a crush of outsiders that the hotel converted the dining room and other rooms into dormitories just to accommodate the crowds. But having to be present and available and on will be physically exhausting to a man in his 60s. Harrison and Clay were already fighting over various appointees in private, with Harrison supposedly having to snap at Clay, saying, "Mr. Clay, you forget that I am the president." Harrison insisted on wandering around Washington, which I think is just a kind of cool image to have of him, completely unaccompanied, and would greet the public, stopping by the Capitol, for instance, to introduce himself to John C. Calhoun, but really kind of making it so that he wasn't this unapproachable figure. He did eventually need to get away. The circumstances at the National Hotel will be super overwhelming. And so he'll head to the home that he had been born in, Berkeley Plantation, outside of Charles City. Go listen to episode 9 of season 1, which I'm just in love with that site. But even there, his neighbor is also his vice president, and so John Tyler insists on hosting a few events while he's there. But Harrison will sneak away to write a draft of his inaugural address in his mother's room. When Daniel Webster, who will be Harrison's appointee for Secretary of State, read the draft of the inaugural address, he said it was so filled with so much Greco-Roman history, it was as if Harrison was trying to prove his intelligence and knowledge of history and political theory, but it went way over his head. And Daniel Webster is a brilliant guy. Webster joked that it had no more to do with the United States than a chapter in the Quran. I love that line. Webster wrote his own speech, telling a friend that he had killed, quote, 17 Roman proconsuls dead. That's how many times Harrison was talking about Roman proconsuls. And Harrison will balk at that draft, though he does incorporate some of the sections into the final draft. But as you know, it will be a huge speech. Harrison then will continue his efforts to present himself as hale and hearty through Inauguration Day, riding horseback to the Capitol, just imagine that, and attending the swearing-in of his vice president, John Tyler, and then giving an inaugural address before a crowd of 50,000, reportedly the largest crowd since Washington's swearing-in up to that time. And yes, that includes Andrew Jackson. There will be veterans of the War of 1812 and then Tippecanoe clubs with log cabin floats coming down Pennsylvania Avenue. Harrison hoped the speech would shed his frontiersman motif and establish him as a strong executive, but delivering that long 1.5 hour speech, sometimes you see 2 hours, without a jacket and exposed to the elements, could be seen as one of the reasons that he will fall sick. In the speech, Harrison reiterated his belief that the executive should be strictly limited, and he will say they should serve one term, a criticism of his predecessors who served dynastically and of the new breed of career politician typified by outgoing President Van Buren. Harrison then emphasized that he would under no conditions serve another term, which had to have been music to Henry Clay's ears. And yes, Henry Clay was listening with both ears, but it was something that Harrison wanted to establish, like, I'm just doing this as a one-off, and we will hear this repeated, you'll remember, with James Polk in the very next inauguration. Now, when we say William Henry Harrison got sick, we aren't sure if he ever truly recovered. Harrison's brief presidency was dominated by the horror that he felt at the impact of the spoils system that we talked about with Andrew Jackson, as the executive mansion was completely overrun with office seekers, his pockets bulging with letters that people delivered to him and sometimes just shoved in his face. This was a period when office seekers and those with official business could come right into the mansion. And remember, Harrison travels by himself, right? Anna's waiting to come when the weather's a little bit better. And so he doesn't really have the family or the wherewithal to say, like, this is my private life versus the public performance. Henry Clay and Daniel Webster will cook up a scheme to dismiss all of the Democrats in the federal government who had been appointed by Presidents Jackson or Van Buren. But Harrison was unwilling to pull the trigger, saying that he would sooner resign than, quote, be involved in such inequity. Harrison's frenemy relationship with Henry Clay turned toxic over Clay's demand that Harrison call for a special session of Congress to settle some of the banking issues, leading Harrison to call him impetuous and write that he thought it was better to discuss things in writing rather than in front of other people, which sent Henry Clay into complete rage. Henry Clay viewed this as Harrison telling him, "Don't you ever come to the mansion. Try to speak to me personally." And William Henry Harrison is just saying, like, "Can we put it in writing? I think about it a little bit before." And their last communication will be trying to clear up that confusion. Congress adjourned, as it did, usually right after the inauguration, until they would come back in the fall, usually in November or December, leaving Harrison without any senators or representatives to torment him, but also that he had nobody to really kind of bounce ideas off of either. By then, his health will have turned, which we'll get to in a second. William Henry Harrison's brief time in the executive mansion did not mean that he didn't entertain. Instead, he hosted at least two big dinners that we are aware of, with one of his daughters-in-law, Jane, filling in for his wife. As we said, she is staying behind in Ohio. As we mentioned in episode 6, former President John Quincy Adams came to one of the dinners, and President Harrison supposedly slapped him on the back, and Adams will give one of the big toasts, and it had to have meant a lot to William Henry Harrison to have the support of former President Adams. Harrison insisted on going to market himself in the first few weeks of the presidency, carrying his basket and maneuvering the streets alone, but soon he became easily recognized and besieged with office seekers, and as I said, they'll be shoving petitions in his face, and again, we had no kind of barrier between common American and our president. There's no Secret Service or body men to kind of make that differentiation. Harrison made news when he bought a cow, and he also purchased a Bible, finding none in the executive mansion, which will be mentioned continuously after his death. And it's a little weird, where we know that the presidents before him were religious and had Bibles, but there wasn't a executive mansion Bible. And so the idea that he brings one there, they say, is like, well, he's bringing religion back after these kind of godless presidents, when that's just not the case. We'll turn now to the death, and I'm sure this is what most of us have been kind of waiting for. This will be our first presidential death as president, and certainly the first ever in the White House. So there's a lot that goes into that. For 100 years, the narrative had been that the cold that Harrison contracted in his inaugural will intensify, and that Harrison contracted pneumonia, and that combined with his old age, that's how he died. We know William Henry Harrison came down with a cold after his inauguration, and he did complain of feeling anxious and fatigued. For instance, right after coming back from his inaugural, when he gets to the executive mansion, Harrison will lay down and had his head and temples rubbed with alcohol before rousing to make his rounds at inaugural festivities, and again is going to wear himself out trying to demonstrate his vitality. For the next 3 weeks, we're not sure if Harrison ever fully recovered, but he's certainly not too ill to attend to the duties or convene his cabinet or even have these parties. And as we said, we know he delighted in doing the marketing and entertaining, so he might have had a cold. We know people that walk around sniffling and that kind of thing. And again, he's trying to, you know, mind over matter, like, I'm going to show them that I'm, you know, healthy. So maybe he was downplaying the circumstances. But all of this changes then 3 weeks into his presidency. The fatigue and exhaustion will have caught up with him. A doctor was summoned on Tuesday, March 23rd, as a routine, but then provided no diagnosis. Harrison felt a spring in his step the next day, and this is when he again went out to market. This will be a big mistake. This is when he gets caught in a rain shower without a hat and coat, and he did not remove his clothes right away when he returned to the mansion. Remember, that's George Washington's fatal mistake as well. Harrison began feeling a high fever and chills, and so another doctor, this time Dr. Thomas Miller, who you'll get very acquainted with, will be summoned on Friday the 26th of March. Harrison, who we remember, had studied to be a doctor before entering the army. He's our first and only president to have wanted to be a doctor before his father's death means that he has to find another way of getting money, and so he goes into the army. But he'll diagnose himself with anxiety and fatigue, complaining of neuralgia, a nerve pain that will send these shocks and affect his head and stomach and extremities. He also complained of dyspepsia, a pain in the upper stomach, which Harrison owed to his fasting. Sometimes he said he would only eat animals, and I'm not sure if that means he would only eat food made from animals or only eat meat. But we do know that he would stop eating. And again, when you're 68, you want to have a steady diet and not be depriving yourself. Harrison had been dealing with this neuralgia and dyspepsia for years. And so the doctor just recommends bed rest. And Harrison will say, "You're right," claims to be feeling better. The very next day, on the 27th, Dr. Miller will be called as President Harrison was complaining of severe chills. Dr. Miller will diagnose mustard to be plastered all over Harrison's stomach, as well as a diaphoretic draft and emetic, all of which will cause perspiration in an attempt to kind of sweat out the illness. Harrison claimed to again be feeling much better, though he said he did have a pain over his right eye. And Dr. Miller noticed that he hadn't emptied his bowels in 2 days, so he prescribed a mercury compound and bitter apple laxative to help. And I should note, if you're at all queasy, like it's going to get grisly, like there's just no two ways about it. Overnight, Harrison began complaining of severe pain again over his eye and on the right side of his body. Dr. Miller ordered more mustard plasters to be applied to the entire side of his body, as well as laxatives and enemas, hoping to relieve the pressure inside the president. The next morning, on March the 28th, President Harrison again claims to be much better, but Dr. Miller will order more of the mercury compound and a rhubarb, ginger, and magnesium oxide laxative, as well as directions for cups to be applied, using hot cups to be applied directly to the skin to raise blisters on Harrison's flesh. This was done instead of the traditional bloodletting that we've talked about before, mainly due to Harrison's advanced age, because one time they do try it and Harrison's pulse will plummet, and the doctors actually feared that they'd killed him. So by this point, Harrison is restless. Again, imagine being 68 and the guy's coming in and like, "I'm going to make you throw up. I'm going to make you do number two, and you're going to be sweating profusely and you can't be touched." Like, it just would be a lot. And so he's demanding like, "Don't touch me. Don't touch me at all." Harrison asked for a tincture of laudanum, which has opium in it, to be applied to his right side. At this point, Harrison's discharge, is what we'll call it, was only black, what they called fetid water, alarming Dr. Miller, who noted that Harrison had very rushed breathing and a racing pulse and was feeling more flush and nauseous. Dr. Miller diagnosed President Harrison at this point with pneumonia, as well as congestion of the liver and derangement of the stomach and bowels. His solution was to give Harrison more laudanum, calomel, and a laxative, all of which will again just exhaust President Harrison. But now he says he's out of pain and able to sleep. Throughout the evening and the next couple days, Dr. Miller will order more laudanum, ipecac, remember that's to make you vomit, camphor, and now we'll add spirit of ammonia, which please leave me without that stuff. And President Harrison was having inconsistent bowel movements with sometimes concentrated urine and then black stool, which was indicating a liver disorder. So it does kind of follow with Dr. Miller's initial diagnosis. On April the 1st, Dr. Miller ordered to stop all of these medicines, but then would apply the mercury compound all over Harrison's stomach area. By this point, Harrison is very incoherent. Whenever he's semi-conscious, he'll just be muttering kind of nonsense and then like picking at his bedclothes. Dr. Miller and another doctor will order warm poultices all over his body, hoping to raise blisters, as well as then giving him a mercury compound, the camphor, and opium every 2 hours. And again, I just want you to put yourself in poor William Henry Harrison's shoes. On April the 2nd, Harrison begins spitting up a brown mucus tinged with blood. Dr. Miller will only intensify the dosage of medicines for Harrison, along with regular enemas, which will only be inconsistent. Harrison has a hacking cough, which they will try to tend to with some cough syrup, but he's also becoming very feverish. On April the 3rd, Harrison's condition just plummets. He'll be suffering from a violent bout of diarrhea, which will again be leaving him feeling feeble. At one point, Harrison will say, "I am ill, very ill, much more so than they think." He starts drifting in and out of consciousness and will be very difficult to rouse. Several times they'll think that they've killed him. Late in the evening, he seemed to recognize that he was near the end. By now, his skin was muddy in color, his pulse was inconsistent, and Dr. Miller noticed that his abdomen was distended. In his last day, Dr. Miller ordered more stimulants, mustard plasters, applied to the extremities and abdomen, along with starch, laudanum, echino, which is a dark red dried juice of certain plants used for tanning and drying. Why they're putting me in this poor man is beyond me. Enema, spirit of turpentine sponging, camphor, and carbonate of ammonia emulsion with a hot brandy toddy. And you can imagine why William Henry Harrison gives up the ghost. The cabinet will be summoned. Vice President John Tyler was at his home in Williamsburg, really kind of unaware of just how bad things were becoming. The only press notice we get is on April the 1st, April Fool's Day, when they say he's fine, like he's recovering, right? And so Vice President John Tyler, who had come to Washington at one point to be near William Henry Harrison, and then is told like, no, he's going to get better. He's an old man and he's kind of sick. John Tyler goes back home. And so, you know, the legend that he's on the floor playing with marbles when he is ascending to the office. When Harrison comes to, he'll say, I want you to understand the true principles of the government. I wish them carried out. I ask for nothing more. It was unclear who Harrison is directing this to, but it's believed that he might have thought that Vice President Tyler had come back to the room with him or never left, and he falls into a delirium. The last rites will be delivered, and President William Henry Harrison will stop breathing shortly after midnight on April the 4th, 1841, dying at 68 years old. He'll be our sixth president then to die, the first to die in office, and the first of only two to pass away in the executive mansion. Initially, Harrison's death was attributed, like we said, to the cold or pneumonia, but later studies have focused on the possibility of typhoid. I found this article called Death in the White House, President William Henry Harrison's Atypical Pneumonia, from Jane McHugh and Philip Makowiak. And it reads, there is ample reason to conclude that Harrison's move into the White House placed him at a particular risk of contracting enteric fever. In 1841, the nation's capital had no sewer system, nor for that matter did any other American city. Until 1850, sewage from nearby buildings simply flowed into public grounds a short distance from the White House, where it stagnated and formed a marsh. The White House water supply, which came from springs in the square bounded by 13th, 14th, I, and K Streets, was situated just 7 blocks below a depository for what they called night soil that was hauled there each day from the city at the government's expense. This would explain why three antebellum U.S. presidents, all in the same decade, Harrison, James Polk, and Zachary Taylor, each developed severe gastroenteritis while residing in the White House. Polk recovered only to die of presumed cholera 3 months after leaving office. Taylor, like Harrison, will succumb to his episode of gastroenteritis while president. At the time, the most a physician could do for a patient with typhoid or paratyphoid fever was to adhere steadfastly to medicine's most sacred tenet, first do no harm. Miller did so to the extent that he elected not to bleed Harrison, which was the standard treatment for pneumonia at the time. Although the myriad medications he gave Harrison during the course of his final illness were standard of care for that time, many are now recognized as overtly toxic. They included a considerable amount of mercury, and yet Harrison apparently never exhibited obvious signs of mercury intoxication. If he had enteric fever, as his case history suggests, the opium that Miller gave him was especially dangerous and might have converted a serious illness into a fatal one. Bowel motility has an important role in ridding the host of intestinal pathogens. The inhibition of peristalitis by drugs such as opium promotes not just the retention of that bacteria, but also facilitates their invasion into the bloodstream. Enemas are also potentially dangerous in such patients because they can cause an inflamed terminal ileum to perforate. Given Harrison's sinking pulse and his cold blue extremities at the time of his death, most likely he succumbed to septic shock, possibly resulting from a perforated terminal ileum. Harrison's wife, as we said, was delaying herself until warmer weather, and so she missed his entire presidency and death. Like we said, John Tyler will be summoned, but arrives after Harrison had died, and he'll take the oath on April the 6th, setting into place the constitutional crisis that we discussed in season 2's episode for John Tyler. Without the First Lady, President Harrison's cabinet was left to put the funeral arrangements together, clearly wanting to model the first presidential death commemoration after the royal mourning familiar to some Americans, wanting to indicate to the rest of the world that our presidents were on the same level as these dynastic rulers. The public had been kept apprised, as I said, of Harrison's worsening condition, but his sudden death will be mourned deeply. And you can see on the website where I have images of when he did die, and it's on the level of when Washington, Jefferson, and Jackson died. This will be our first presidential funeral. And again, how do we mourn someone of that stature? And what traditions could be started will be considered. Harrison's body was shaved, and an attempt at embalming him was likely attempted using salt. Harrison was placed in a cedar-lined coffin covered with black velvet and silver lace. Former president and now representative John Quincy Adams came to the executive mansion to pay his respects and was shocked that the body was unattended in a hall when he showed up. Harrison's body was placed then in a mahogany coffin with black velvet and gold lace, and they laid him in the entrance hall for mourners to file by. The coffin had a window through which the mourners could view Harrison's face. Black cambric and black mourning elements were placed on every surface in the mansion. They covered the chandeliers, mirrors, portraits, all in this black fabric, and that'll be winded around the exterior columns and the windows, and then this is done in every other federal building. On April the 7th, President John Tyler and former President Adams, as well as future President Zachary Taylor, will be among the attendees at an invitation-only service in the East Room, featuring 30 pallbearers to represent every state and territory. Around Harrison's coffin, mourners will place flowers, and there was a floral centerpiece on the coffin with two swords, representing the sword of justice and the sword of state, and there was a rolled-up copy of the Constitution placed beside those. Harrison's coffin was then placed in a walnut coffin, which was then placed in a lead coffin. They were very careful about this. Harrison was then taken by the Capitol building in a mile-long procession led by Harrison's riderless horse, Old Whitey, and containing veterans and military and government officials. Harrison was processed then by the Capitol to Congressional Cemetery, where he'll be buried after a cannon was fired 68 times. Again, they loved doing this kind of thing. It's estimated that around 40,000 people will view the processional. Some of these precedents will stick. William Henry Harrison will be the first president to lie in state in the East Room of the White House, always reserved for those presidents who die in office. We've never had a president who died out of presidency lie in state in the East Room, but not every president does. In a few weeks, we'll talk about Zachary Taylor also lying in state in the East Room, Abraham Lincoln will as well, William McKinley, Warren Harding, Franklin Roosevelt, and John F. Kennedy all lie in state in the East Room. The only president who does not is James Garfield. They bypass the White House. They never come back into that residence. In terms of lying in state in the Capitol, you'll notice that William Henry Harrison goes by the Capitol building but does not lie in state in there. Same thing will happen for Zachary Taylor, where they both will immediately go to Congressional Cemetery to be in a temporary burial vault and then go home. But after Abraham Lincoln lies in state in the Capitol Rotunda, we will start to see that becoming standard for presidents who die in office. And a few who die out of office. Those who died in office will include Abraham Lincoln, James Garfield, William McKinley, Warren Harding, and John F. Kennedy. Franklin Roosevelt does not lie in state in the Capitol. Former presidents who lay in state in the Capitol building include William Howard Taft, Herbert Hoover, Lyndon Johnson, Dwight Eisenhower, Gerald Ford, Ronald Reagan, George H.W. Bush. So it is something that you're able to do. Not every former president has, but it is something that they're able to do. They're an automatic, if their family chooses to do so, they're immediately granted that opportunity. While most people are bereaved, former President Andrew Jackson could barely contain his delight. He wrote, "Let the nation rejoice. A kind and overruling providence has interfered to prolong our glorious Union and Republican system, which General Harrison and his cabinet were preparing to destroy under the dictation of the profligate demagogue Henry Clay." Again, he does not rest as long as Henry Clay is breathing. Now we'll turn our attention to the grave site of William Henry Harrison. As we had talked about, he is initially buried in a receiving vault at Congressional Burying Ground. This is the same vault that we talked about with John Quincy Adams. Of course, Harrison is in it 7 years before. So it's a public vault on the exterior. He's going to be resting there. And then 3 months later, we'll be ready to go back to Ohio. On June the 26th, his body will be removed after a ceremony attended by John Scott Harrison, Harrison's son, President Tyler, representatives from both houses of Congress. Harrison was sent to North Bend, Ohio by a barge attended by Marines for the entire trip, which lasted 11 days. William Henry Harrison will be buried in a marble sarcophagus in a newly built vault at Mount Nebo on his property. The area has since been made into a housing development, which we'll talk about. But years before, William Henry had come to the spot to view the progress of his estate in the valley below and selected this as his resting place. Initially, that vault will be very unassuming, just 20 square feet, and will have 5 feet that are underground and just 2 above ground, made of brick, stucco, and wooden shingles. It will resemble a bunker, and please visit the website where I have images of it. You wouldn't know that's a president's gravesite. Other Harrison family will be buried there, around 24 coffins accumulating over the course of the next few decades. This is the vault where Anna Harrison will be buried in 1864, when she'll die at 88 years old, surrounded by family in North Bend. Anna would be, as we mentioned in season 2, the first president's wife to receive a pension, awarded $25,000 from Congress in a lump sum. Anna and William Henry had 10 children, the most of any presidential couple. Only John Tyler had more, but he had his between 2 wives. But as I talked about, they suffered enormous tragedy, losing 5 of their 6 sons before William Henry had been inaugurated, including 3 in the 3 years right before, 1838, 1839, and 1840. So that's the mourning I'm talking about that had to have added to his stress and fatigue. Anna would lose all 3 of her surviving daughters in the next 4 years, leaving her, by 1844, with only 1 surviving child, John Scott. Anna worked hard to win her grandsons, military and government appointments in tribute to her husband, and she'll encourage her grandsons to fight for the Union during the Civil War. After her 22-room house burned down in 1858, Anna will move in with John Scott and his large family, which contains her comforting grandson, who you know as the future president, Benjamin Harrison. The vault was severely neglected as the Harrisons moved from the site, with the original structure, as I said, brick, now has a kind of sod roof, needing really good renovation. In 1879, a restoration covered the brick with cement, but grass was growing in the cement. The Illinois Central Railroad, built nearby, left the site even less desirable and far louder, and the site was frequently covered with grass and weeds, and the vault fell into bad disrepair. Now, as we talked about before, John Scott's body will be stolen from the cemetery he was initially buried at, and so there will be the fear that the same thing will happen to President William Henry, leading family to offer to sell the site to the state of Ohio as long as the tomb was maintained. The tomb continued to deteriorate, with visitors coming more for the scenery than to pay their respects. Even grandson Benjamin Harrison's election left the gravesite neglected. In July of 1896, out of office now for several years, Benjamin visited his grandfather's tomb and was just appalled by the conditions. He envisioned creating a more grand tomb for all Harrisons to be memorialized, but died in 1901 before that could be realized, and he'll be buried in Indianapolis. Commemorations for the Battle of Tippecanoe or to build a flagpole visible from the Ohio River never materialized, and the neglect started to irk the family. Plans were made to consider moving Harrison possibly to Fort Meigs and Perrysburg, where Harrison had a major victory in the War of 1812. Adding insult to injury, in 1912, a young boy got trapped inside the tomb after a prank from friends where they locked him inside, where he's screaming for his life before being rescued. And then the very next year, vandals set a, quote, unsightly substance all around the tomb. So finally, in 1919, a house bill will be allocated to give more than $10,000 to place a tomb on the site in a, quote, suitable and decent condition, in order that the memory of Ohio's president and gallant soldier may be fittingly commemorated. The state finally purchased the land from the Harrison family. I should know it's 48 years after they first offered, and now was in charge of maintaining the tomb. The William Henry Harrison Memorial Commission was created in 1921 to study the area for improvement. After landscaping, a new entrance will be built, and the initial steps to the site will be buried with a new vestibule put in place, and you can still see the disconnect when you go inside. A 60-foot tall limestone shaft will be placed in front of the initial tomb, and another door added. The interior walls will also be raised, and you can still see that line when you go in today. The new tomb was dedicated in 1924 with a marker providing information about the site. The obelisk, some will say shaft, lists Harrison's titles: Secretary of the Northwest Territory, Delegate of the Northwest Territory to Congress, Territorial Governor of Indiana, Member of Congress from Ohio, Ohio State Senator, United States Senator from Ohio, Minister to Columbia, 9th President of the United States. Inside the tomb is William Henry and Anna's tombs, listing the names and birth and death dates. And as I said, John Scott's is right next to theirs. The state of Ohio ceded care of the tomb to the Ohio Historical Society in 1934. The site was added to the National Register of Historic Places in 1970, and the Harrison Sims Memorial Foundation was formed in 1990. A member from that group comes every day to unlock the tomb to allow visitors to go inside. There have been some embellishments. A cylinder in front of the grave that contains a quote from Harrison's inaugural address, reading, "As long as the love of power is a dominant passion of the human bosom, and as long as the understandings of men can be warped and their affections changed by operations upon their passions and prejudices, so long will the liberties of a people depend on their own constant attention to its preservation." At the base of the stairs leading to the tomb are two pillars, with eagles' heads facing each other. One reads that the memory of Ohio's first president and gallant soldier, William Henry Harrison, may be fittingly commemorated. The other reads, "This memorial is erected by a grateful state." Now, about you going to visit the site, the website says that it is open year-round during daylight hours, and that has been my experience with one exception, and we'll talk about that in a second. But when you go, you'll arrive in North Bend. There are signs leading you to the site where you'll see Harrison Tomb signs from the highway. And then as you get closer, there's a parking area right across from Congressional Green Cemetery. And then there are placards about the Harrison family, mainly about William Henry, but also has some about North Bend and about Benjamin. Once you park your car, and there is handicapped parking available, then you can process to the stairs where you'll see the two eagles, you'll see the pillars, and then the stairs leading up to the site. Once you get there, it's a pretty nice kind of promenade. You can look down to the river, and then you can look up to the shaft. And like I said, it has all of that text written on the outside, and then go in through the doors. It's a pretty kind of low-ceilinged area. Once you go inside, there is usually a gate that's closed that you can then look in and see where William Henry and Anna. There's a big placard that reads all of the information, mainly about the erection of the new tomb content when they did the new granite shaft. All of that information is contained there. But you can see John Scott and then a lot of other Harrisons and Harrison adjacent people who I'm not really familiar with, but the main feature, of course, is William Henry. The Ohio Historical Society has added an additional placard that talks about his death, and then, you know, that's kind of the site. One of the features that's very striking about the tomb, of course, is that as you approach, it has a very kind of modern feel with the pillars and with that striking granite obelisk or shaft. But then when you go inside, it has that kind of old world, almost dungeon feel. And so you have the mustiness of a room that's like that, that's been locked up forever. And you see these different vaults on the wall and all of the brick and clearly water damage over the course of some time. And it's just a old meets new aesthetic that you don't get from the outside, but only when you go inside. It's just a really kind of cool experience to get to see. It's a little dark inside as well. And so if you're looking for that kind of classic gray site experience, it's definitely one of the tombs that's the most striking in that way. I've gone now four different times. My first was in June of 2015 when I had first visited. This was that trip where I had first gone to Louisville and gone by Zachary Taylor's gravesite. And this is when I was like, you know what? I should make a point of it. So on my way home, that's where I stopped in Cincinnati and was like, okay, I'm going to go to William Henry Harrison's. I knew Ulysses Grant's birthplace was right around there as well. And so I just made a day of it going to those two different sites. When I arrived at William Henry Harrison's, I had no idea what to expect. I'd done no research. I can't emphasize enough how little I was prepared to start down this path. And that's just less than 10 years ago when I started doing this, but I got to the site, parked as I indicated, and then made my way up. And it is beautiful, right? Like, it's exactly what you would expect for a president and certainly of the mourning tradition that we had here. It was my understanding at the time that this was the way the site was always meant to be. And so it was really kind of fascinating to learn about the initial tomb and that like bunker that they had for him that the shaft now completely obscures. But how overwhelming the site is and how well appointed it is, that's kind of what I expected the site was going to be. I was also really interested in seeing the birthplace of Benjamin Harrison and the home. And so if you listen back to episode 23 of season 1, hear about the birthplace at North Bend and I talk about the property. And then I also mention it in season 2's episode 9 when we talk about the homes of William Henry. But the whole area is just kind of interesting how after the home burns down, they just sell the property and make it now into a housing development. So when you're driving around North Bend, you'd have no idea that this was all William Henry Harrison's property and that there's really no vestiges of it left other than this gravesite, which would have just been a part of that larger property. My second visit came in August of 2020. It's in the middle of the pandemic. I remember it was the day that Joe Biden announced Kamala Harris was to be his running mate. So that's what I remember from that day. I wanted just to check out William Howard Taft's birthplace. I wanted to go back by Point Pleasant and then come to the gravesite once again. And so did go by the gravesite and the gate was locked, right? So you got to go up to the gravesite and kind of peer in, but I wasn't able to go inside. And I just noticed on the website that they did talk about like you no longer need the masks. So apparently it was done out of an abundance of caution with people transmitting COVID. My next trip came in July of 2022, where now I wanted to go inside William Howard Taft's birthplace after COVID and the COVID restrictions. I stayed at my friend Mindy Rue's home and so then woke up the next day. She lived in Eaton and so just went down around North Bend and went to the gravesite and it was open again as I kind of hoped and experienced the first time through. My most recent visit came this January when I was coming down to New Orleans to celebrate my 40th birthday. I was riding around with my friend Stephanie, who you can hear in a guest episode from season 1, but we were driving down to New Orleans and I was like, oh, it's early in the day, let's just stop by these places. And so I stopped by William Henry Harrison's tomb, Zachary Taylor's tomb, and then we did Abraham Lincoln's birthplace. But here it was super cold, it was early in the morning and the tomb was already open, so giving you a good indication this is the day after New Year's, just that they are ready to go and welcoming people. Stephanie was really kind of surprised at how elaborate the tomb was and the conditions of the site, that it looked great, that it was really well maintained. Again, I was just really excited to get to share that site with another person that, you know, could enjoy kind of setting. And so exactly what I had experienced on that first trip, just really nice to see it well maintained even now. In terms of William Henry Harrison's legacy, he has towns in Michigan, New Jersey, Tennessee, and Ohio. I should note, in Ohio, there's also a town called Tippecanoe and another town called Tip City, which was initially called Tippecanoe City. So I learned that. There's also 4 counties in 4 different states. There are statues of Harrison prominently in Indianapolis and Cincinnati. There's one across the street from his home in Vincennes, so Grouseland, if you listen to that episode. And there are some in small towns throughout Indiana. Lafayette has one, for instance. And then there's also the William Henry Harrison statue in Rapid City. I've taken pictures with the one in Vincennes. So in December of last year, when I went to Grouseland for my revisit, and then the one in Rapid City, I also have a photo of that, as well as his bust in the Virginia State House, where they claim all of the presidents. And you can understand why, you know, somebody who was born and raised in Virginia and then claimed by Ohio, why that could rankle, but why he has a prominence in Virginia, Indiana, and Ohio now. In terms of the gravesite, I think this is a great example of a glow up where you had the initial bunker. You get a good sense of the initial mourning process that we were using for a president and how we didn't quite have it together. And when you look at 1841, when Harrison was initially deposited there, you know, the 6th president to die, most of the presidents that we were talking about were put in places on their property, or in James Monroe's case, where he's going to be at a kind of public cemetery in New York City with John Adams, he's going to be in a church. But none of them had this elaborate place where the feature was to come and view the gravesite of that president. That will come later. Even Andrew Jackson, who will die 4 years later, he's going to kind of sublimate his legacy into the resting place of his wife. And so we still weren't to this place where we had these elaborate burial places that were befitting a president. And the current state of William Henry Harrison's tomb, the way it looks now with this granite shaft and beautiful overlooking the Ohio River, you can see it from the highway, all that stuff. That is something that is more emblematic of what we'll see in the coming weeks when we start talking about the tombs of Abraham Lincoln and James Garfield and Warren Harding, that whole line of presidents in the really kind of Victorian era, as we get more elaborate with our mourning. With William Henry Harrison, again, they were kind of making it up as they went along. And I can't underscore enough how important the rise of the highway, where the ability to go and visit these sites doesn't really happen for a lot of people. Even Benjamin Harrison, right? Your grandfather, the president, he only goes to the gravesite once. And so, you know, maybe he went a couple other times that we don't know about, but hey, how often were people going to travel to visit these places before the car, before the highway system? So, you know, really reminds me again of when we talked about James Madison, where it's like your family took care of your body, your family put you where they knew. And so William Henry Harrison is actually more in line with what we talked about with George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, and Andrew Jackson, where they're buried on their property. And the family was just going to keep note of it. It's believed Anna's grave was unmarked until they do the renovation. That gives you an indication, again, of that notion that like the family just knows approximately where you're buried. And then future generations kind of just understand like that's where grandma and grandpa were buried, that kind of thing. And it's only now that we're like fascinated by like, well, where exactly? I found an article about John Scott's gravesite where he's listed as being buried in the vault. And when you go there, you'll see John Scott Harrison. But there is some speculation that that might not actually be him, that when his body was initially stolen, that it might not have actually come back to that place. And so, again, there's just a lot of loose ends that we're much more fastidious about today, but they just were not there all the way back here. Now, I'd be remiss if I didn't bring up the Curse of Tippecanoe, which if you listen to my Halloween episode between seasons 2 and 3, you'll remember, and some of you probably know this off the top of your head, where it's a story that's going to only kind of come into being in the 1940s, where somebody points out a strange coincidence that the presidents in these 0 years, so the presidents every 20 years, are going to die in office, and starting with William Henry Harrison and going all the way through the election of Ronald Reagan. But with William Henry Harrison being elected in 1840 and dying a month after being inaugurated, Abraham Lincoln being elected in 1860, getting shot in 1865, James Garfield being elected in 1880, getting shot in 1881, William McKinley getting reelected in 1900 and getting shot in 1901, Warren Harding getting elected in 1920 and dying in 1923, mysterious circumstances, I should note. Franklin Roosevelt being elected for a third term in 1940 and then dying in 1945. John F. Kennedy being elected in 1960 and being shot in 1963. And then, of course, with Ronald Reagan. Now, the legend did start to circulate even before the third election of Franklin Roosevelt. And so it was something that they have different publications where it was seen before John F. Kennedy was murdered. So it is one of those things that probably did have to feel pretty eerie. I did find where Jimmy Carter was asked about it in 1980 when he's running for re-election. And he said, well, I'm going to keep doing my job until the day it happens. And so if it happens, whatever, like I can't plan for it. I'm not going to avoid doing it. And there had to have been that kind of fear, certainly Nancy Reagan, where she is going to work really hard to keep her husband safe. But there is some speculation that she might have designed events around his presidency to avoid anything like this occurring. And so I got to imagine on late March of 1981, where there had to have been some kind of speculation like, oh my God, what if this happens? The only president to die in office, not elected in these every 20 years is Zachary Taylor, who we'll talk about in a few episodes. So just one of those weird coincidences. I don't know that you can put much stock into it, but I'd be remiss if I didn't say anything about it. And so I think that's usually the biggest thing with William Henry Harrison. The other thing that comes to mind is my friend Stephanie and I love this episode of Drunk History that you can find on YouTube, where they do go through the death of William Henry Harrison, but somebody who's intoxicated, you know, is giving the details of William Henry Harrison's death. And so he gets into this laughing jag over having snakes thrown on him, which I never found that William Henry Harrison had snakes put on him, but I also wouldn't be shocked if they did say at some point, you know, Dr. Miller was like, hey, let's just attach a couple snakes to poor William Henry Harrison. And then famously in the middle of his monologue about the death of William Henry Harrison, he takes a phone call and says, I'm drunk, Ma. I drank a lot of booze. Happy Mother's Day. And so every Mother's Day, Stephanie and I will text that, and it's a connection with William Henry Harrison. So thought you might enjoy that. I might put a link to that on the website as well. So if you're at all inclined, I just think it's funny. All right, with that, we will turn our attention next to William Henry Harrison's vice president and former neighbor, John Tyler, and his gravesite at Hollywood Cemetery. We'll be going back to Richmond for Hollywood Cemetery, so you won't want to miss that in 2 weeks. With John Tyler, we'll have another very interesting post-presidency, one of our few presidents to return to a legislative position. He'll be elected to Congress, but not for the United States. So you'll want to listen for that reason as well. Remember to check out visitingthepresidents.com, where you can find previous episodes, links to the associated readings for various presidential sites, my photos from various trips, recommended readings, and so much more. You can also follow along on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Just search for Visiting the Presidents. Also consider supporting Visiting the Presidents by writing a review or donating through PayPal. All season, I've been bringing you content from William D. Gregorio's complete book of U.S. presidents, Louis Picone's The President is Dead, and I also highly recommend Brady Carlson's Dead Presidents. For William Henry Harrison, check out Freeman Cleave's Old Tippecanoe, William Henry Harrison and His Time, and Gail Collins's William Henry Harrison, as well as Norma Lois Peterson's The Presidencies of William Henry Harrison and John Tyler, as well as Robert Remini's Daniel Webster, The Man in His Time. Thought that was kind of interesting to get Daniel Webster's perspective. And then also I'll link to the source that I was talking about with the death and how they're speculating it was enteric fever rather than pneumonia. And you can do your own research and see what you come to. All right, with that, I look forward to seeing you out there on the road as we continue to visit the presidents. See ya.